I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about guns. We're going to talk about gun violence, gun safety, gun rights, and gun laws. Few subjects divide Americans and Hoosiers more than the issue of guns, and tragedies such as the one at Sandy Hook Elementary School remind us of how high the stakes are. We're going to talk about how we deal with guns in this state and country with a great group of guests: State Senator Jim Toms, school safety consultant Chuck Hibbert, Steve Dunlop of Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence, and Heather McCabe, a professor at the IU School of Social Work. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits at WFYI.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the topic of gun control. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Got a great group of guests with me today. Republican State Senator Jim Toms. Senator Toms, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. Chuck Hibbert, who is a school safety consultant and retired Indiana State Trooper. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
It's good to have you here. And Dr. Steve Dunlop, who is with Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence. Dr. Dunlop, welcome to the program.
Hi, Grant. Great to be here.
So, good to have you. And with me here in the studio is Heather McCabe, who is a professor with the IU School of Social Work. Heather, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And I'm going to start this show with a little bit of a disclosure. Maybe the two or three people out there who have followed my career over the years know I've written frequently about guns and staked out a position that I think probably we could have more sensible gun control and gun laws in this country. For the purposes of this conversation, though, what I'm going to try to do is just see that we get all sides aired in a clear and dispassionate way. And we're going to focus the bulk of the early conversation on Senator Toms because he has to leave us after about 20 minutes to actually go do his day job and be a senator. So, Senator Toms, can you talk a little bit? Obviously, there's a lot of concern in the country right now about the levels of gun violence, the numbers that we're seeing. What is the solution, in your view?
Well, there's a, you know, if we'd analyze this problem, I think if we were serious about this, it may take us away from the object of guns and lead us into a direction that might resolve some of the problems we're wanting to fix in our country. But right now, I'm a little disappointed how quickly this nation has been channeled to focus on guns and types of guns and a product or an accessory of a gun, which really doesn't connect with the violence in our country. As though right now, I've been listening for the past 3 or 4 weeks of all of the debate on TV and radio, and I've been involved in multiple interviews and programs myself. But when you listen to this debate about gun violence, it's as though we are almost willing to accept, I know this is not factual, but it seems like we're willing to accept murder by other means just so it's not a gun. You see what, you follow me? I would rather us analyze what has happened in our society that has brought about this level of violence. Because if we look back 40, 50, or 60 years ago, which we had guns back then, we never seen or heard news accounts of school shootings or massacres in movie houses. And so for that point, I would like to make is that I'm happy to discuss guns and gun laws, but if we want to address the problem of those massacres, then I think we need to be on a different road that will bring about solutions for that.
Well, and which road would that be, Senator?
Well, I look at analyzing what's happened in the past 50 years. For example, the farms. If we talk about guns, it's obvious that the industry itself has made such improvements on that product, on the safety factor of the quality of those firearms, the powders, the primers, the bullets. There's been an improvement over that product by the industry. But then when we look at society, we now have, for example, entertainment. I'm not laying it all off on one particular factor, but entertainment, for example, that we are affected by that. We're affected by what we see. If that's not true, I don't think people would advertise and put commercials on to sell their products. But looking at some of the movies that we see today, I mean, there's one that just started playing a few weeks ago or a week or so ago called Bullet to the Head. Those type of violent movies, we can't discount the effect that has on the human mind, our music industry. And we have a culture of people that are willing to abuse drugs, whether they're illicit or are prescription drugs. We have a breakdown in the family unit. And these are the things I truly believe that have more impact on why we're dealing with these tragedies than the inanimate object of a gun or its particular appearance or what it looks like.
Well, though it would seem to me if we're going to talk about that, and I'm playing devil's advocate to a degree here, Senator Toms, if we're going to look at placing some limits or guidelines on films, songs, and all of that, that has some First Amendment implications, and we put that part of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution in play. Can we not also put the Second Amendment in play as well if we're going to subject some parts of the Bill of Rights to reasonable limits? Can the Second Amendment be part of that as well?
Well, my objective here is to I'm not trying to go in with a strong fist and squeeze to death the First Amendment like what this current administration is doing with the Second Amendment. I'm looking at an aspect of, as a society ourselves, are we willing to admit that the culture we live in is not conducive to raising a respectable American? I mean, we do have a lot of young people growing up that are productive. They've set goals in life. They've done well for themselves, and they intend to do well. But we have an atmosphere that is very difficult for a child to grow up in anymore without being influenced by these elements of vulgarity, violence on TV and movies, violence just in the schools. And I'm not talking about guns. I'm just talking about bullies and those kind of activities and the lack of I've been to a lot of the schools in my district, and I see some of these children coming out of homes that are hard for me to imagine because I didn't grow up in a home like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to understand that when a child grows up in those kind of environments, it does have an effect. And I'm not a psychologist, but we understand it does have an effect on that little mind, that impressive mind, and how they're going to behave when they get 15 and 25 and 30 years old. And I'm just a little bit alarmed that today, as a nation that professes to be so intellectual, how we can tend to wrap an inanimate object and give it a life of its own when it doesn't. Those are just tools, no different than steak knives or ball bats or automobiles or anything else. But we have a nation of people that own firearms, that enjoy collecting them, enjoy shooting, competition shooting, recreational shooting. 99.9% probably of people that own every type of firearm that's right now on the hit list,
mm-hmm.
that enjoy those firearms and would never contemplating committing a crime. But the elements that do commit crimes would do so with any type of firearm they can get their hands on. And my question is, rather than worry about the firearm they have, if I was staring down the barrel of an intruder in my home, I wouldn't worry whether his gun is a prohibited gun or a banned gun. I would be concerned about what's he going to do and why is he in my room, my house. You see what I'm saying?
To some degree. I guess where I would go then, are you arguing that guns play no part in this problem?
Well, I say when we see a story where someone is bludgeoned to death or stabbed to death, I would say a gun law would not have had any effect on that, would it? Would you agree to that?
Well, I'm asking the questions in part. I guess what I'm saying is, in terms of the argument on the other side, and maybe I should bring Dr. Steve Dunlop into make this case so that I don't have to play the devil's advocate quite so directly. But I guess it's hard to bludgeon 30 people to death in a matter of minutes unless you really know what you're doing. It escalates, the firearms escalate the stakes. Dr. Dunlop, would you like to step in at this point?
Sure, I don't mind. I think one thing you might want to consider if you talk about whether inanimate objects have something to do with the outcomes is, first, that you might want to look up north to Canada. I think Canada shares a lot of the same media we do. They have the same language. They have about 75% murder rate by non-gun means that we have, but we have 10 times the murder rate by guns that they have. Now, almost all homicides are carried out, most of them by far are carried out by handguns. They're not carried out by semi-automatic weapons. That's a special class, and it's a special problem. And Canada has about one-tenth the handguns that we do. And in Canada, you can't get a handgun unless you can show some sort of cause to have it. Additionally, if you look at suicide, kills a lot. Firearm suicide kills more people than firearm homicides do. And in Indiana, for instance, in 2010, we had 461 firearm suicides and 222 firearm homicides. And if you look at the number of households that own a gun by state in the United States, you find that in states in which there is a high household gun ownership rate, say 47% or higher, there are far more suicides, and these are virtually all firearm suicides, compared to states that have low firearm suicide ownership rates. In fact, a study was done over a number of years that found 14,365 suicides by firearm, but for men in high gun ownership states, and only 3,900 by firearm in low gun ownership states. However, suicides by other means, hanging, poisoning, gas, and so on, were almost identical, 6,573 in the high gun ownership states and 6,781 in low gun ownership states. Now, here is where the access to a firearm affects the outcome. And it's been shown in Switzerland, it's been shown in Finland, which are also high gun ownership areas, and in the United States. Many people commit impulsive acts when they're feeling suicidal. And if they do it with a gun, they're dead 95% of the time. And the people who kill themselves with firearms are clinically different from the ones who use other means. They're less likely to be chronically mentally ill. They're more likely to be married. They're more likely to have a job. They're less likely to have ever made a previous attempt. Of course, you only usually get to make one with a gun. And there's more likely to be alcohol involved or some precipitating life event, some loss of a job or loss of a relationship. So in those situations, the presence of a gun influences the outcome. For the states involved, which included about 50 million people, it was about 2,000 people a year who were dying additionally. And the single thing that you could pull out to identify was the presence of a gun in the household. So guns change. By the presence of a gun, you change the dynamics of a situation.
Are there any, and I'll toss this back to Senator Toms, do you accept those figures as accurate, Senator Toms, that the Dr. Dunlop?
Well, I think I've read where two-thirds of the gun-related deaths are suicide. It's noteworthy that law enforcement has a higher incident of suicides than the civilian population. It's like 18 per 100,000 as compared to the civilian population of 11 per 100,000. And so, using that, should we maybe disarm our police department? Because oftentimes those suicides are done with a firearm, sometimes with their own service pistol. In fact, we had a case here 4 weeks ago here in Indiana where
Dr. Dunlop, we're going to talk one. Yeah, let Senator Toms finish his point.
Sure.
We had, about 4 weeks ago, we had a deputy sheriff here in a southern town in Indiana that was on the force only since November, 26 years old, and he took a handgun and shot himself in the head. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he pulled through or not. He was sent to the hospital in Louisville, Kentucky. But, you see, we could, like I say, we can get off on this direction of trying to zero in on the firearms, and using those statistics, we might say then perhaps with the law enforcement having such a higher rate, maybe they shouldn't have guns. And this, my point again is, and mm-hmm. I appreciate everybody's concern about firearms, and I understand a lot of people who don't know anything about guns but are hearing what the news has been telling them will automatically parrot what they hear. I still say, and I still maintain, that if we're going to seriously approach the this kind of activity in our country, mm-hmm. rather than surfacing and focusing on guns, which most of these firearms are owned by legitimate citizens, they're never committed in using a commission of a crime, I would prefer that we look and analyze what has happened in our culture, what's happened in our citizens, what's going on in our young people in the homes that they're growing up in that turn out the kind of shooters that we have. When, again, we had these guns 56 years ago, we had them 100 years ago, but we never had school shootings. I doubt whether anybody that's going to be on your program today could give me five cases of a school shootings on massive scales back in 1965 or 1960.
Well, there have been school atrocities in the past. There was one actually right before Charles Lindbergh flew across the country. Somebody blew up a school down in Arkansas, if I'm not mistaken. The only reason it's not a bigger story is that Lindbergh did fly across and dominated the news the next day. We are talking about gun control here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can shoot us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Senator Jim Toms, Chuck Hibbert, Dr. Steve Dunlop, and Heather McCabe. We'll be right back. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about gun control, gun rights, gun violence today on No Limits. It's part the first part of a two-part series we're doing. Thursday, we're going to take up the subject of mental health, the connection between mental health and gun violence. My guests have included so far Republican State Senator Jim Toms, who has since left us because he's got to go into session over at the State House, Chuck Hibbert, who is a school safety consultant and retired Indiana State Trooper, Dr. Steve Dunlop, who is connected with Hoosiers concerned about gun violence, and Heather McCabe, who is an assistant professor with the IU School of Social Work. I'm going to toss this to Heather right now and say, you provide some context. Is this a new problem? Are there trends that we can see? You've done a lot of research on the subject. Can you give us some sort of overview?
Thanks. No, gun violence, unfortunately, is not a brand new problem. Certainly, we have media in a different way than we've had for years. These mass school shootings, there have been school shootings in the past, and there's a history of that. But certainly, when Sandy Hook happened, we saw an event that I think, you know, people talk about things that shock the conscience, and I think that happened. I was happy to hear the senator certainly talk about the concerns about gun violence in society, or excuse me, violence in general in society, and I share some of those concerns. Certainly, the issue of mental health and particularly lack of access to mental health is concerning, but I also think that it makes sense that we take this time to take a look at what we're doing with regulating guns in a common sense way, many of which would not actually prohibit gun ownership.
Chuck Hibbert, I'm going to pull you in real quickly. One of the proposals that created kind of a firestorm of controversy was the National Rifle Association's proposal that we put armed guards at every school. Is that a good idea? Would it make schools safer?
Well, I believe it would make schools safer, but the reality is, John, we're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. The International Association's chief police analyzed the NRA statement, and just for example, and of course, security guards, you know, it's all about training when it comes to that particular aspect. Big supporter of school resource officers and school police departments and officers trained to the highest level before we would do that. But the International Association of Chiefs of Police took the NRA's example and said, well, what if we put police officers in the building? And to do that in our public schools and charter schools and non-public schools across this country would reduce our police resources by 1/6. And the reality is, John, from my perspective, mm-hmm. is we're just simply not willing to do that. We're not going to spend that type of money. People say, well, you can't put a dollar value on a child's life. And my point is, we do it every day. Mm-hmm. And so is it something I could support? Absolutely. If it was clearly defined, the training was exceptional. And please understand that placing someone, a security guard, or even a police officer, a well-trained, certified police officer, inside a school environment, takes much more than what that officer's training may have been up to that point. If we're talking about simply putting a gun in the building, mm-hmm. then I think, you know, then let's put someone on patrol on the outside, like the Israelis have. Mm-hmm. The Israelis have, for many years, had armed Israeli soldiers on the perimeter of their school buildings, carrying Uzis. Now, I'm not quite comfortable with that, but I do understand the concept between, you know, are we going to prevent someone from entering the building? If so, then let's put our armed person on the perimeter of the school grounds.
And does that not take us, though, to a certain uncomfortable acknowledgement here? Part of the reason the Israelis do that is that they've been on a war footing for 65 years.
Yes.
And in theory, we're not supposed to be on that footing, although one of the numbers I see that's disturbing is that, you know, in the 10 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, we lost about 2,000 people. Gun violence claims about 4 to 5 times that many people in this country here within our borders every year. Heather McCabe, is that an accurate?
It is. We see about 30,000 gun deaths per year in the United States. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, too many of those are to people 18 and under, certainly mm-hmm. not all. Some of them are homicides. More of them are suicides. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the rates of gun deaths, the U.S. looks more like a country at war than any other type of country.
We are talking about gun control and gun violence here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. John, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Your question, please.
Well, I talk to people who seem to be literalists when it comes to the Constitution and just read it directly and don't want to infringe on my constitutional rights. And the Second Amendment's very short, one sentence, two clauses. We all seem to be talking about the second one, mm-hmm. but the first one already qualifies the second with regard to well-regulated militia. It seems like we're not getting enough of the well-regulated part of it, not having a director of the ATF or nobody wants any sort of regulation when it comes to it. But can you talk about how the first clause kind of applies? Is there room for both?
I will toss that question to Heather McCabe first. I know that is actually a source of contention. Thank you very much for the call, John. Very much a part of the argument that Second Amendment advocates say is that first clause really isn't germane to the discussion. Do you agree? Disagree?
I disagree. I think that certainly we've seen it read in different ways, but the most recent case in the Supreme Court, the Heller decision, did invalidate the law that it was looking at in Washington, D.C., which was a ban on handguns. But one of the things that we don't hear folks who are excited about the decision talking about much is that the court actually said this regulation goes too far. However, there may be regulations that are allowable that don't go too far. And so I think to say that we need to ignore that first part, or to say that there can be no legal regulation of guns following Heller or at all, is an inaccurate statement. We are now left to say, what are the bounds of those regulations?
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Ann in Monrovia. It says, the courts have accepted that virtually all of the amendments have limitations. There are already limitations on the Second Amendment. Fully automatic weapons are illegal, for example. It would be reasonable, I believe, instead of attempting to ban semi-automatic weapons, to instead limit magazine sizes to 8 to 10 rounds, require universal background checks, end all internet sales of weapons and bullets, end the sale of body armor-piercing bullets to the general public, limiting it to the military and the police, and fully fund research into gun injuries and violence. Until there is a body of research, it will be impossible to create good public policy regarding guns in this country. And it is important, I believe, to note the Second Amendment does not give one the right to bear arms against the United States government. Stephen Dunlop, I'm assuming much of what Ann says you would agree with.
Yes, I think so. And the courts, you know, the Heller decision is the most recent decision by the Supreme Court, but there have been many others, and they have taken differing views of what the first clause means.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you think about the problem of gun violence in the United States, there's sort of three parts of it that are important. One part is suicides, and mm-hmm. I think there the data is in that there is a clearly relationship between the presence of a gun in a household and the risk of suicide to occupants in the household. Now, that can be lowered and controlled if people lock up the guns and lock up the ammunition, and only the person who owns a gun has access, so that you can at least keep the risk down to the actual owner and not spread it to the whole family, is what happened. And actually, that's exactly what happened in Connecticut, mm-hmm. where a woman who would have passed any test to get the guns had the guns, and her unfortunately mentally ill son killed her and then killed all the children. So suicide is one problem. Another problem is crime guns, and this is really mostly handguns. It's mostly young men, and the difficulty here is that in Indianapolis, high school kids can buy a handgun on the street for $200 or less, and law enforcement is powerless to prevent it, and it's pretty much powerless to track back and penalize anybody who sold the gun to the kid. And that's where the universal background checks, the requirements on gun owners to report lost or stolen guns,
mm-hmm.
All transfers being tracked so that if someone shoots somebody with a gun, you can track that gun back piece by piece from the original owner right through all the people who've had it. So if somebody's out there selling on the street, you can have a chance to pin them down, where now you really cannot do it. So what we're basically saying, unfortunately, to our kids by this lack of regulation is, have a handgun if you want one. And the kids who are getting them are, by and large, the kids who are doing poorly in school or dropped out of school. And what they're using them for, unfortunately, is mostly to shoot each other, sometimes over very trivial provocations. And I think that kind of violence between the kids has always been there. The difference we have now is that we're arming them so well. When I grew up, West Side Story was a new show,
mm-hmm.
and you remember there were gangs in West Side Story, and it was a big deal that one member of one gang had a handgun,
mm-hmm.
and a whole song about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now you expect if two gangs come together, half of them have not only a handgun but probably a semi-automatic handgun.
We're talking about guns and gun violence here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to make sure that we also give Senator Tom's concern, though, an accurate and fair consideration. We've gotten an email from a listener named John. There seem to be a lot of them calling in or writing in today. That gets to kind of the divide here. It says, I fear guns. Others fear not having guns. How do we resolve that? I cannot imagine shooting accurately to defend myself without periodic training, at least once every 2 years, if not more often. What I guess the first part of that email is the part I would like to get to, which is that cultural thing. Heather McCabe, why is it in this country? I know we've talked about the difference in some ways. Our sister country to the north, Canada, mirrors us in so many ways, but this is a much bigger problem for us than it is for Canada. What is it about guns that speaks so powerfully to Americans and the American culture? An easy question.
I would say not an easy question, and certainly what I would say would be conjecture. We developed this country breaking away from Great Britain. We have been individualists in this country. We've been a bootstraps country. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And we have traditionally in this country we stand for rugged individualism, and this idea that we should be able to have our guns and it's part of who we are culturally has been with us for a long time. And you can look at the history of the court cases. You can look at the history. The fact that they put an amendment in regarding this speaks to how people felt about their guns even at the time. We need to keep looking at that. And I grew up in Indiana. I've been around hunters. You know, hunting is a large part of our culture in Indiana in rural areas, some in urban areas as well, but primarily rural. It takes time for people to change their ideas.
Chuck Hibbert, what is it you think that speaks so powerfully? Why guns speak so powerfully to us Americans?
Well, I think the Second Amendment is one of those reasons why. Certainly not an expert at all in handgun violence in this this country, but I, as a person who has carried a handgun for over 43 years, I do respect and understand why people want to carry their handguns. I know I do, although I clearly don't have it with me today. I'm sitting in an elementary school in Solon, Ohio, and Ohio, like Indiana, prohibits firearms from being on campus, and rightfully so. But I do understand that there is a great deal of concern on the parts of individuals that with our escalating not only homicide rates, because we're doing a much better job of patching up people who used to die on the streets. The EMS people have gotten much better in our emergency rooms, so we're seeing a lot more aggravated assaults, I think is the phrase that is currently used in law enforcement circles. So I just think that there is a general distrust by people who've owned guns, that the government limits will not stop.
We are talking about gun control, gun violence here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Tim, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Your question, please.
Yes. There for both sides. The first one being for the people that want to first off, I'm a certified gun nut myself.
Okay.
I've been around them ever since. I'm 61 years old, been around them all of my life, lived in a little country hamlet where Saturday mornings you'd wake up to people either shooting rabbits or squirrels walking right down the country road. So, that's been around them a lot. But looking at this from both sides, people are searching for a simple answer, and I don't think you're going to get there from here. On the one side, if you look at gun control, do you really think that that's going to cure the root causes of what happens during these tragic events? On the other side, if you don't have gun control, do you really think you're going to cure the culture's ills? What's changed in those 60 years when I grew up to now with a quick fix? What other quick fix are you going to get? So I'm right on the fence. I don't know what to do. You know, I've got a couple of dozen guns in my own house. I like to collect War One, War Two semi-automatic weapons.
Mm-hmm.
I just like them. But you either have the Second Amendment that says I can have these, or you don't.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the call, Tim. And we will take that up in a moment. You can join the conversation. We're talking about guns and gun violence here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Chuck Hibbert, who's a school safety consultant, Dr. Steve Dunlop, who is with Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence, and Professor Heather McCabe with the IU School of Social Work. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about gun control, gun laws, gun violence in this state and country. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. My guests are Chuck Hibbert, who's a school safety consultant and retired Indiana State Trooper, Dr. Steve Dunlop, who is with Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence, and Heather McCabe, who's a professor with the IU School of Social Work. Right before we went to the break, Tim called in, and I think he speaks for a lot of people in this state and country who are honestly conflicted about what we should do. You know, on one hand, they believe in the Second Amendment and those constitutional rights. They're also, though, concerned about the levels of gun violence in this country. And I should note, as a factual matter, we've been focusing on the Second Amendment. Indiana's Constitution doesn't have any of the well-regulated or militia language in there that people argue about. It pretty much says you have a right to own a gun, you have a right to use it to defend yourselves. I guess Dr. Steve Dunlop, someone like that who is conflicted and sees this really as a collision. My grandfather used to have a useful saying. He would say the really tough questions in life aren't whether right and wrong collide, because you can figure those out most of the time. It's when two rights collide and you've got to elevate one priority over another. How would you talk to someone like Tim?
Well, I would say, first of all, I think you need to look at what people who are interested in stronger gun laws want. Because a lot of people, the rhetoric out there is that we want to go down some sort of slippery slope and finally just take all the guns away. And no one's articulating that. People in the organizations that I'm aware of are not concerned about hunting rifles. By and large, they're not concerned about shotguns. They really are concerned about only two kinds of weapons. One is handguns, because those are the crime guns, and they're not concerned about people who own them legally. They're concerned about people who shouldn't be getting them, who are getting them so easily because we don't control the marketplace. And then the second kind of weapon that we're concerned about are weapons of mass murder, you might say, weapons that can kill a very large number of people in a very small amount of time. Because our concern in there is that if these are made available to people, there really isn't any way to regulate them that I can imagine that would prevent something like what happened at Sandy Hook, except, you know, going the Israeli method and just arming ourselves against ourselves, you might say. Because the Sandy Hook incident involved a woman who had a, under any law in any state, I think, could have obtained the weapons that she had. Her son was 20 years old. She wouldn't be even required to store them so that he couldn't get to them. But she made a big error in judgment. She didn't realize, and her son, apparently, from what little I've read, and I, by the way, practiced psychiatry for 33 years, so I know a little about mental illness,
mm-hmm.
didn't talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody really knew much about what he was thinking. But he was pissed off about something that I think that she was going to move or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got the guns and killed her and then went off and killed all the kids for reasons that we'll never be able to explain because we can't talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so just the existence of those kinds of weapons broadly through the population creates this risk And I think the most reasonable way to do that is to limit certainly the magazine capacity and possibly the type of weapon, because I guess I'm not that expert with them, but assault weapons are probably easier to aim and shoot than pistols are. Then you're more likely to be, you can hit people at a greater distance and so on.
We are
but we're not, you know, that's the kind, what we're interested in is cutting down on the amount of violence associated with crime, because guns are, increase the violence associated with crime. They don't get rid of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
Our crime rates are about the same as the crime rates in Canada mm-hmm. or Europe. But what they, with one big exception, homicide.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because guns are used so often in the commission of our crimes. So we want to bring down the violence associated with crimes, and we want to protect against these horrible incidents. And then beyond that, I think what we simply want to do is educate people about the risks involved with gun ownership so that they protect themselves from them. As the senator was saying, with the police, they have a very high suicide rate. I'm sure that an easy explanation for that is that they all have lots of weapons, and maybe they aren't.
And they do stressful work.
And they do stressful work, but firemen do stressful work, yeah. And they don't have the same suicide rate.
We are talking about gun control, gun violence here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Beth, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Your question, please.
I hear from various people that one of the reasons we need all these guns is so the good guys can get the bad guys. And I just wondered if your panel had any statistics or anecdotes about the number of times that the good guys have taken out 26 bad guys in 5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you very much for the question, Beth. Heather McCabe, that one's got your name written all over it, I think.
That's a great question, Beth. I'll tell you, I don't have statistics on when the good guy has taken out 26 bad guys at the same time. But we do have a study by Kellerman that showed that homes with guns in them, those guns are more likely to be used either for suicide or to injure someone that you know than to be used in self-defense. I will say there are some who disagree with that study, but from what we've seen, it looks like it was a sound study. So I think that does raise to my mind questions about this good guys, bad guys information that you're referring to. So I think that was a good question.
We're getting close on time and getting a lot of email questions. I'm going to try to synthesize a couple of them. Here, we've gotten one from a listener named Jane and one from Sam. They both deal with Columbine. Sam says that he was glad that we brought up the Bath school disaster, which resulted in 44 deaths, because it demonstrates that it's the person, not necessarily the means, that results in devastation. And then says Timothy McVeigh killed 168 without firing a round. If guns aren't available and someone wants to commit mass murder, they'll find another way. And says Columbine happened in the middle of the last assault rifle ban, proving that a ban won't mean anything. But Gene takes a different tack and says, again, making reference to Columbine, armed guards in schools did not stop Dylan Klebold and Eric Harrison, 1999, at Columbine. I'm going to toss this one back to Chuck Hibbert. Let's reframe this. Instead of focusing on the guns, let's focus on the schools. What do we need to do to make the kids safe?
Well, just a technical point here, John.
Mm-hmm.
The school resource officer assigned to Columbine High School actually was out of the building
mm-hmm.
At the time that Harrison Klingbold entered. In fact, they waited till he was outside the building. Now, they did exchange gunfire with him.
Mm-hmm.
But they, frankly, they had superior firepower than the officer did with his handgun. So just to cage that historical fact.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sorry, the question was again?
Well, really, how do we, let's take this from the other end. How do we make the schools safe?
Well, I don't think necessarily arming school staff and putting armed guards. As I said earlier, I am a big supporter of well-trained school resource officers and school police department officers in schools, but I think also we really have to go back to some of the fundamentals. I have been in three school districts since the first of the year, where we still aren't locking all of the doors. We're not taking some of the fundamental steps to address reasonable approaches to school safety. So I really would encourage your listeners to ask what's going on at their children, or their, in my case, my grandchildren's schools, in regards to keeping them safe, and are they taking reasonable steps? Frankly, the answer to that question, as I see it, is some places are. Unfortunately, too many places are not doing the job that I think parents expect.
Ernest, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Your question, please.
Yeah. All my life, I've heard people who are supposed to be experts on the subject puzzled over what the exact meaning of the Second Amendment was and why it's in the Constitution. And yet, from time to time, I've run across the reasons, and it is well documented. This well-regulated militia is short for well-regulated slave patrol militia, which was a group of people who were trained to randomly but systematically throughout the South mainly to enter the homes of the slaves in looking for guns, looking for anything that could lead to uprisings. And there were frequent uprisings among the slaves. And in the South, slaves outnumbered the white people. Mm-hmm. And that was a constant threat. And people like Madison and a number of people like Patrick Henry, who was actually opposed to the idea of slavery, were terrified of what would happen if some of these uprisings got out of control. And a number of people would not, the founders, would not allow the Constitution to go into effect unless it included this provision for continuing to clamp down on the possibility of slave uprisings.
Well, thank you very much. Ernest, we're getting a little tight on time, and I want to take up your point real quickly. Thank you very much for the call.
Can I tell you quickly where you can find information on this?
Yeah, very quickly.
It's Tom Hartman has done the best summary of this that I know of, and I just put in slave patrol militias in Google and read his article. He's done a very nice.
Great.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ernest. Right, appreciate it. I want to actually broaden Ernest's point here a little bit, because there is, I know, in addition to Mr. Hartman that he referred to, Gary Wills, some other folks have done analysis of the language of the Second Amendment and the history and said, you know, for example, just the, even in the clause that people in theory don't argue about, Wills' argument is the fact that they refer to bare arms, meaning it's military language. It's not, you wouldn't talk about using a gun for personal defense or for hunting purposes or whatever any more than you would call a stroll over to see a neighbor a forced march. Heather McCabe, is do we misinterpret the Second Amendment? Are there, I guess where I want to go with this is, you know, is there a reasonable possible reinterpretation or a look back? Can we gain anything by looking back at the origins of the amendment?
Well, I think it is certainly interesting to look back at the origins, but I guess from my perspective, as a practical matter, what matters at this point is how the U.S. Supreme Court is interpreting what the Second Amendment means. It has somewhat changed over time. There, at one point, it was perceived as more of a collective right to bear arms. The U.S. Attorney General's office under Ashcroft actually did, in fact, say it was an individual right to bear arms. So again, right now, we seem to be in a period where the courts are interpreting it as an individual right. However, they're not saying that it's a right without any possibility of regulation.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Michael who asks, I'm just going to, he talks about the fact that we share media with a lot of the other parts of the world, but asks a fundamental question that sort of steps away from the question of the guns. Why are there so many angry and violent people in the U.S.? Dr. Dunlop, in about 45 seconds, do you think you could take a stab at answering that one?
Well, I'm not sure there are more than there are in other countries if you look at crimes other than homicide. I mean, there are lots of angry and violent people in other countries. I think they don't create quite so much problem for their societies because the altercations they get into don't lead to as much injury or death. I worked for 6 months in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And Australians are well known. I mean, first of all, among other things, Australians, as you know, many of them started off as convicts in England and got shipped to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And they're vigorous people. They fight a lot. They often bash each other, is the term that's used in the newspaper. So-and-so was bashed with a golf club or a stick or something. But in the town I was in, there was not a murder. It's 100,000 people or so, and I was there for 6 months, and there were no murders. Plenty of fights, plenty of violence, but no murders. And I think, again, it has to do, to some extent, unfortunately, with the fact that we're so well-armed when we do that. By the way, I want to go back to another point,
sure.
And that's good guys versus bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a nice thing for the NRA to say, but it isn't really true.
Mm-hmm.
What it is, it's just people with guns, and people are sometimes good and sometimes bad,
mm-hmm.
and good people can have a bad day,
mm-hmm.
and bad people presumably once in a while do a good thing,
mm-hmm.
but it's the consequences of when things go bad for good people or bad people that is a concern in terms of access to weapons.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener who says, in regard to the discussion about gun control, let's not blame those with mental illness. People with special needs are usually more likely to be the victims. Heather McCabe, in about 15, 20 seconds, you're nodding your head in affirmation. Is that the case?
From what I understand of the statistics, that is, in fact, the case. And so certainly to assume that this is only about people with mental illness, I think it's wrong. And we need, I think that if this raises an opportunity to get additional access to assistance for people with mental health, that would be mental health issues, that would be a great outcome. But I do think that we need to be careful the way we talk about it because of this very reason.
And I should say that our next show on Thursday, we're now twice a week, by the way, for those of you in central Indiana, we will be here on Tuesdays and Thursdays, will be about the connections between violence and mental health and the effects. I feel like we've just gotten a start on this conversation here, and I want to thank actually all of my guests and all of the listeners, because this is one of the more thoughtful conversations I have heard about what is an incredibly volatile subject. I want to thank Senator Jim Toms, who was with us for the first part of the show, Chuck Hilbert, who is a school safety consultant and retired Indiana State Trooper, Dr. Steve Dunlop, who is with Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence, and Heather McCabe, who's a professor with the IU School of Social Work. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.